You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 10th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, hello.
How's everybody this week? Braving the snowstorm, this late March crazy-ass snowstorm?
Yeah, right?
February was 60 degrees around here, and now it's 20 degrees a month later.
Yeah.
So,
Evan, it was 60 degrees last week. A week
okay,
ago,
so
it's 60, and now
generous.
It's 20 and snowing.
20
Not
degrees.
Fair.
The high today in LA was 88.
Oh, man. Yeah, we had a cold week, and then we got smacked with, what, by what, 18 inches of snow?
Nor'easter.
So, this is a funny story. I have to tell you the story. Jay and I were doing some work on the video studio in my basement.
Uh-oh.
And we needed to drill a hole to get Ethernet cable down from my router down to the basement.
Mm-hmm.
So Jay's there drilling away. I'm upstairs feeding the router line through. And then Jay yells up to me, "Steve, I'm seeing water coming out of this hole."
It was more like, Steve, water! There's water coming out of the hole!
Steve, you fell for that?
And that's, when you're drilling in your house and then water is coming out, that's never a good thing. Nothing good that could be.
First of all, there was like three other holes there that the electrician drilled, and we just wanted to make like a bigger hole so we could see through it. So I'm like drilling like right next to other holes, right? And apparently I hit the little rubber line that goes to the refrigerator.
Oh, yes.
Right? Okay. So
tiny little thing.
They don't carry a lot of water. But so anyway, I'm up there. I'm on like a 6-foot scaffolding. And I'm like squeezing my drill above an I-beam, and then I pull out my paddle bit after I drilled the hole, and water comes out. And my first instinct was stick your finger in the hole, right? Stop the water. So
yeah,
I do it.
It worked for the little Dutch boy.
Right, but I'm like, hold on a second. So I do it, and immediately I go, I'm going to die from electrocution. And I whip my finger out of the hole because, you know, there's other stuff. There's wires, you know. It could have been anything. I could have hit a bunch of stuff. So then I start screaming up to Steve. He's yelling at me through the hole in the floor, which mm-hmm. I thought was very funny. So we put
linear.
Like a pasta. Steve grabbed like a pot that you'd boil a lot of pasta, and we stick that up underneath the hole. Steve turns the water off, and then we're like, we should never be drilling into any floors or holes ever again. No walls, no floors. We're strictly like exterior, you know, finished wall people.
Well, unless you know for sure. When you start
it seemed pretty safe. We were drilling right next to an existing hole. But I think he just trapped he had to go at a weird angle. And I think he just trapped that hose against the wall and drilled right through it is what happened. Because it's loose. I mean, the other thing is unless you trapped it, shouldn't have been a problem. But anyway.
Right.
So I thought we had dealt with it because we figured out it was the connection to the refrigerator. So I shut that valve off and it seemed to stop, but the valve isn't great. It didn't completely turn the water off. So there was still a slow drip, which we just,
oh, right.
I left all the pots in place and I checked on it the next morning and yep, you know, it was still dripping. So then we had to get the emergency plumbers over the weekend there. And
here's your problem.
You call the local plumbers.
Someone drilled into this water line.
I swear to God, Mario and Luigi show up to my
house. Yes, exactly.
It's me, Mario.
I mean, they couldn't have looked more like Mario and Luigi if they were trying.
Or jumping on a mushroom or something.
They had to be going for that, Steve, because it's too much of a coincidence.
I know. After they walked out to the truck to grab stuff, I say to my daughter, I'm like, okay, so which one's Mario? Which one's Luigi? And she's like, I know, right? I didn't want to say anything because, you know, I thought it would be impolite or something. It's like,
that's right.
Totally.
Just because one jumped over a barrel, another grabbed a sledgehammer. Why go right to stereotypes?
They were a comedy routine, those two guys. But they got the job done. For a reasonable price, so everything is better now. But
phew, lesson learned.
No blind drilling. All right, we have a great show for you this week. Kara, you're going to start with a what's the word?
Yeah, so the word this week was actually recommended by a listener of the show on Facebook, Jacob Flora. And he recommended that we talk about fractals.
Ah, yes.
Aren't they great?
Oh, I love fractals. God, they are gorgeous.
All right, so I looked up in the two kind of standard bears, Merriam-Webster and Oxford. Similar definitions, a little bit different. Merriam-Webster, any of various extremely irregular curves or shapes, okay, got it so far, for which any suitably chosen part is similar in shape to a given larger or smaller part when magnified or reduced to the same size.
Self-similarity, yep, key attribute.
Yes, we got similarity. We've got congruence, right, if it gets larger or smaller. Oxford, a curve or geometrical figure, each part of which has the same statistical character as the whole. Interesting, that's a different way to look at it.
Yeah, like
they're useful in modeling structures like snowflakes in which similar patterns recur at progressively smaller scales and in describing partly random or chaotic phenomena such as crystal growth and galaxy formation. So a little bit more applied there. So yeah, there's so many beautiful fractals that you can look up online. And if it's a really high-res image, you can zoom and zoom and zoom and zoom and zoom, and you'll see these recurring patterns that happen at smaller and smaller and smaller scales. Fractals occur in nature. They are utilized in a ton of different scientific fields, from geology to atmospheric science, all the way to complex math like fractal geometry and chaos theory. Now, the term fractal was first coined by Benoit Mandelbrot in 19...
Mandelbrot.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
I just say Mandelbrot. I say Mandelbrot, but maybe...
You say
I've said Mandelbrot.
Yeah, I say Mandelbrot.
I think it's probably Mandelbrot. Like, it's Benoit. It's not Benoit.
But it is Detroit.
It is Detroit.
Well,
that is
we
true.
Americanized
except this
that
guy
one, yeah.
was actually in France.
Well, Detroit was named after Detroit, which we just
Detroit,
Americanized
right.
to Detroit.
But then we Americanized it. Yeah. So the word itself directly translates to never-ending pattern. The word is actually a French word. Fractal is a French word. It comes from the Latin fractus, which means interrupted, irregular, and actually broken. It comes from an earlier form called frangere, which is to break. It was first coined by Benoit, or by Mandelbrot, in Les Objets Fractales, where he actually said this quote, "Many important spatial patterns of nature are either irregular or fragmented to such an extreme degree that classical geometry is hardly of any help in describing their form. I hope to show that it is possible in many cases to remedy this absence of geometric representation by using a family of shapes I propose to call fractals or fractal sets." And it's funny because when we talk sometimes about neurological phenomena and in reading Oliver Sacks' incredible book, Hallucinations, and also his book, Migraine, he refers to fractals quite a lot because these are common visual hallucinations, either during migraine or other hallucinatory states. Really cool how often you see them in nature. And just in your kitchen, if you have, for example, any sort of cruciferous vegetable, oftentimes you can see fractals on the surface
broccoli.
There. Yeah, broccoli. Good example of that. Cauliflower.
My favorite natural example of a fractal is a coastline because it's so intuitive. Like if you just look at the coastline of a continent from space, it has a certain amount of, you know, wiggliness to it. And then the more you zoom in, it pretty much stays the same. You're just getting a higher resolution, but you can zoom all the way down to the even the microscopic level, you know, and it still is kind of a wiggly, you know, coastline.
Yeah, it has these conserved images. And then, of course, you can get to perfect fractal geometry through these incredible kind of psychedelic patterns that a lot of artists like to create using their computer.
There's so much more about the coastlines and fractals, though, because if you looked at different countries describing how long their coastline is, the numbers were wildly divergent, even the same coastline, because it all depends on the measuring tool that you're using. If you're measuring with a yardstick, you're going to come up with a shorter coastline than if you used an inch-long ruler, because your little tiny ruler is going to follow all the nooks and crannies. So you could say, well, my coastline is 100 miles long. It's like, no, I measured your coastline. It's 200 miles long, and you're both actually correct. It just depends how much. So the interesting thing about fractals is that when you start using the ideas of a fractal dimension, you can look at a fractal like a coastline and then apply a fractal dimension to it. So say something like, give it a 1.3. You know, it's more than one-dimensional because it's so curvy, but it's not two dimensional. So it's like a 1.3, 1.2, whatever. And then using that number, you can then plug that in and then you can calculate a more reasonable, consistent way to measure a given coastline depending on its fractal dimension.
I just found the email from Jacob Flora who sent this in, and he actually sent me some stunning images. He said, I work with an applied materials group in chemically prepared toner, and he sent me a picture from the bottom of a toner waste beaker where the dried crystalline polyester resin that they use was kind of fractalized by their cyan pigment. And it's just stunning. It looks like a lightning strike.
So I was curious as to what is the study of fractals? Is there an official category? Well, I came across a website called Fractology. And here's what it says. What is fractology? At its core, fractology is holographic healing, working simultaneously on the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual level that transforms your physical body and consciousness. So I guess what I'll say to that is beware the fractal trap. Just because somebody is borrowing the term fract or fractal or something like that does not necessarily mean that they're using it correctly.
Right. Wow.
They just use it as jargon, you know.
I looked up how to pronounce Mandelbrot, and at least one website, YouTube actually, says Mandelbrot.
Yes. I'm sure at least one website does.
Bob, is that your favorite?
It looks like in the language, it would be either Mandelbro or Mandelbra. So it's like Mandelbrot, but the T trails off. They don't actually
What's
pronounce
up,
the
Mandelbro?
T.
Hey.
Yeah, it's less Mandelbro. And that sounds super American when I say it. Hang on. Benoit Mandelbleu.
But apparently I'm reading that his name was Polish and was Frenchified.
Yeah, because he was French.
He Frenchified a Polish name and now we're Americanizing it. Okay, Jay, you're going to start off the news segment with a couple of news items about hominid skulls, one of my favorite topics. I love
hominid.
Yeah, a new study published in the journal Science reveals that a partial skull that was discovered in the Xuchang province in central China has human and Neanderthal features. Now, if this doesn't sound amazing to you, that's because you don't know shit about paleontology. I mean anthropology.
Paleoanthropology.
It's still paleo.
Close enough. Whatever.
Anthropology apology.
So these findings have, they've never been discovered before. The partial skull they found had a large brain and is similar to early humans across the old world. And some features like the low and wide brain case that rounded onto the inferior skull. Now that means everything to Steve, is found in living humans today, people that are alive today in Eastern Eurasia, which is really, really awesome, right? The interesting thing is that the skull, it has features that are found in Neanderthals from Western Eurasia. For example, the complex design of the back of the skull, which is really cool, and the semicircular canals. So there are similarities here between modern human skulls and these Neanderthal skulls. So the fossil record was weak in details like this regarding early man's predecessors, which were people like we just found, these skulls. And the skulls give us the wonderful data on who and what these people were. The skull's features help paint the picture of how early man evolved and where they traveled to and from. Very cool. You know, they found two skulls. One was excavated in 2007, the other in 2014 from a location that's estimated to be about 105 to 125,000 years ago. And the skulls were once belonged to good hunters, they think. This is what they assume from what they found there. They found a lot of clues near the skulls, like stone blades made out of quartz. And there were also the remains of horses and other cattle, giant deer, woolly rhinoceros. These guys were hunters, or they just rolled with a pretty epic crew. I think that's cool. They find these two skulls. They find features that shows an association between Neanderthals and early man, which that's freaking amazing, guys.
Now, but honestly, though, but it's not that surprising in that we already know from DNA analysis that Homo sapiens, that we have, you know, 1 or 2% Neanderthal DNA. And so at some point there had to be some, you know, hanky-panky going on between Neanderthals and humans.
Yeah, baby.
The question is, how frequently was it happening? And the fact that we're finding any fossil evidence of the combination shows that it actually had to be, you know, not uncommon, I would say.
Yeah.
So, Steve,
yeah.
does it surprise you, though, that humans, early man, was able to mate with Neanderthals?
No. Jay, there was another article also published this week, which is interesting. They found a piece of a 400,000-year-old archaic human skull. And the scientists actually did not designate a species name for the skull. And they did that deliberately to make a point. And so the question is, can we actually divide up early or archaic humans, you know, our most recent ancestors, into distinct species or not? Or is it really just all a mishmash? And I think these authors are saying,
what?
Yeah, you really can't do it. I mean, think about it this way. All living dog breeds, you know, as different as they look, they're all one species. In fact, they're all wolves. They're all the same species as Canis lupus, right?
Wolfy.
They're just a subspecies. Yeah. They're just considered a subspecies.
Well, what does that mean? What's a subspecies?
Canis lupus domesticus, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what does that mean?
They can have fertile. You know, a dog and a wolf can mate and have kids.
And have babies, know? Yeah. It's not like what liger or something that then can't make more babies.
Well, why call them a subspecies? Why not just call them the same species? That's what I'm trying to get at here.
Well, yeah. So that's a good point. And that's kind of the debate that's going on is, you know, these lines are all fuzzy. And, you know, can you really make a distinction? Like, are there really distinct populations here that we're talking about? Or are they all just interbreeding left and right? And, you know, we're seeing so few puzzle pieces. It's not really showing us the, you know, anything close to a good representation of all the populations and all the interbreeding that's going on. And it's just an illusion. The notion that there's the, you know, Denisovans and, you know, this kind of archaic human and that kind of archaic human. It's like, yeah, that's just sampling. That's just, you know, a bias of too little sampling of all.
And half the time, those samples are pieces of bones. Like, they're not even complete skeleton. I mean, think about the dinosaur record, for example, and how many times paleontologists have been wrong. They might have thought something was a totally new species when it was really just in the growth cycle of a different species.
Exactly. Right. And I think it's very probable that, you know, everything after, let's say, Homo erectus, so after Homo erectus, including all, you know, not only modern humans, but Neanderthal and all the archaic humans, probably could all interbreed and have fertile young.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy because, you know, comparing it to modern, you know, society, there aren't like other types of humanoids around.
No, not anymore. What about Florenziensis? Was that more? That was more modern than Erectus.
Yeah, Florenziensis, which is still not 100% established as its own species. There are still two schools of thought. But even if we think that, you know, that the school of thought that says it is its own designated population, you know, genetically distinct population, probably still would be fertile with modern humans.
So can you imagine? So it's possible then that one of the rare so-called species that we have found. Give me an example of one where we've only found maybe a couple of examples.
The Denisovans.
Denisovans.
We have a tooth. And the only reason we know it's a species, you know, it's a distinct population is because it was recent enough that we could do DNA analysis.
Okay.
And the DNA wasn't quite human and wasn't quite Neanderthal. So we couldn't sort it out by DNA. So we said, okay, well, it's its own population that's related to, you know, to obviously to early humans, but it's just...
Why can't we find more of it?
Yeah. Who knows how big a population it was.
See, where'd they find a tooth? I mean, did they dig it up?
If it's part of a find. It's a, you know, a fossil site, you know, where people were living and there's artifacts and they found a tooth, you know.
That is, what an epiphany. That is so cool. Like,
that is cool.
That it's such a, I never really thought about that. You think of these, there were these stable populations. Sure, there was some screwing going on, but no, they must have been f***ing so much that it was just so fluid, they don't even want to give a species name to them anymore. That's awesome. Yeah.
So, Steve, is it a very clean demarcation line when they couldn't produce offspring together, right? That's when you would say there's a difference here.
Yeah, so there's no question that two things are different species when they cannot interbreed. No question. But there's a continuum, you know, from being in the same family, right? Like, we're brothers, right? You go from us to people who share, like, are also Italian, to Europeans, to, modern humans to just keep going out and out and out. There's no demarcation. There's no place where you would say that's where the line should be drawn to separate a species from a subspecies from a different species. It's a continuum. It's a continuum of nestled relatedness. And so it's kind of arbitrary. And then, but it's worse than that, because not only is there nestled relatedness, then it's all getting mixed back together with interbreeding. So,
right.
Yeah. So it's not like, so if you look at like different species have nestled relatedness, like we're closely related to chimpanzees, less so to gorillas, less so to monkeys, less so to horses, less so to reptiles, but there's no interbreeding mixing those different layers. But with our human ancestors, the interbreeding mixes it all back together. And so it's even worse. It's even more fuzzy. So some scientists are saying we should just not do this. It's actually misleading to try to separate them and to pretend like they're distinct populations.
Yeah. It's like a big human soup, you know? You have this Neanderthal and a human mating and producing, you know, maybe Denisovians or something. But then you have them interbreeding with a human or a Neanderthal. So then it's like you have another gradation there. It's like, oh my God, it's like this never-ending mixture. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Well, and we can kind of calculate backward based on present day DNA samples, but it's so difficult when you're looking at fossils, right? And you can't get DNA. It's one thing if you're looking at, you know, extant species and you're trying to figure out, are these the same genus but different species, you know, whatever. You just look at their DNA. That's like what we do now.
Right.
Yeah, you compare their hips and you compare their bones and stuff, but then you just look at their DNA and you know. But it's really hard when we can't kind of double check our work, I guess.
Although we can back to about 40,000 years, Kara.
Which is pretty cool.
Which
is awesome.
This
one's what, 400,000?
400,
yeah, but we're
so
talking
much.
About 10 times that.
It's too far.
But didn't you guys think, though, that the humans killed all the other species?
No. That's.
Well, not killed.
No, but
in
I
a
think
sense.
that was kind of the prevailing thing when it came to specifically to Neanderthal. Not all the other species, but specifically, I think that the kind of
like we out-competed
prevailing
them,
story was that we outcompeted Neanderthal.
Yeah, but it, you know,
we survived.
The actual answer from what we're discovering now is that it really wasn't like a fight. It was more of like we just kind of merged and became one.
Well, but Neanderthal DNA only makes up like 2% of most people.
So listen, I think it seems pretty clear that at least in Europe and Asia, modern man outcompeted Neanderthal. I think that's pretty clear. If you just look at gene frequency, you know, gene frequencies were greater, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we directly fought them. There's other ways to compete. Some scientists think that, listen, Neanderthal man was adapted to the Ice Age, right? They were big boned. They were thick. You know, they that was their adaptation. And after the last glacial period, or it wasn't not the last one, but whatever, 40,000 years ago, after that glacial period, modern man was more adapted to the current situation than Neanderthal. So the Neanderthal gene frequencies decreased, but there was enough interbreeding for them to, you know, contribute a couple of percent to our DNA. So it's complicated. You can't come up with some simplistic narrative about we fought them and killed them, or we out, you know, whatever. We competed with them. Sometimes we didn't compete with them. We interbred with them. Everything happened, and just you're just looking at gene frequencies. And at this point, you know what I mean?
Okay, well,
it's interesting.
That is interesting.
I wish there were more evidence. I wish there were more evidence.
Yeah,
though.
We need more fossils.
More,
yeah,
more,
right,
more,
yeah,
more.
The thing is, we're still in that phase where the more evidence we get, the less we know. Right?
Like
the more we know that we
well, the
don't
more it becomes
know,
complicated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We haven't started like filling in the missing pieces yet. We're actually just expanding the puzzle, if that makes sense.
We were so cocky 30 years ago. Now we're stupid.
I don't know. I don't know that having taken a course on human evolution 30 years ago, I don't remember being cocky. I think it was, we like are just barely scratching the surface here. And it was still at that time, every skull was like, whoa, we got to like redraw the lines. And it's still that way because I think we're expanding the puzzle. We're not just filling in known borders. But it's cool. It's cool. And again, because there's, you know, the recent evolution we're looking at with such high resolution and it is so complicated. My God, there's almost going to be no limit to how far we're going to drill down. We're never going to be done. It's only a matter of how far down I'm going to be able to drill. All right, Bob, I understand the solar roadways coming along. Not so much. What's happening?
Oh my God. You guys remember the solar freaking roadways?
Yeah. They're back in the news.
How could we forget?
Yep. And it appears the tech is still apparently not quite ready for prime time. Now, the hubbub happened.
It's not like it's a total disaster.
Oh boy. Some of these details were incredible. So just for a quick overview, remember they're going to turn road surfaces into solar power generators, essentially producing most, if not all, of the power that we need, while also handling the punishing environment that we call roads. It's an amazing environment in and of itself. The smallest unit of this futuristic solar road is this thick and transparent, these hexagonal plates. These are the SR3 panels, Solar Road 3, I guess the third iteration of these panels. They also incorporate LEDs for signaling and messages and also heating elements to potentially even melt snow or ice, which would be pretty awesome. There was even talk of adding these little pressure plates that could detect animals or kids on the road and then use the warning LED lights to warn, you know, to warn drivers, hey, there's an animal or a kid on the road ahead or whatever. And then alongside this amazing science fiction road, alongside it would be this new energy grid to transport all this clean energy to all the parts of the country. So that's what they were touting and they've been touting for years. And it sounds it sounded amazing and even more science fiction-y than you would even think. Like, if you had to come up with a high-tech road, in a lot of ways, this is even better than what you would come up with. So, but as it turns out, you know, I'm a techno-optimist, but this vision seemed pretty pie in the sky, even over short-term and even mid-term. It's just like, damn, this is just way too much. So, and ultimately, the questions were endless, and they were endlessly troubling. How would these panels handle not only the weight of cars, but 18-wheel trucks? What about snowplow damage? What would happen? What about road heaving, you know, the heaving that creates potholes and stuff that you then hit by with your car and it makes a really loud noise and you destroy your tire and have to spend $200 because of one pothole. Never mind. That happened last week. Other problems would be, you know, how would, you know, these are non-sun tracking panels. I mean, they're not going to be tracking the sun. So, you know, what's that going to do for the efficiency? How is that going to possibly work? And then, but most importantly, what about when you factor in the cost of materials, installation, maintenance, new infrastructure, and this thing, how could this thing not cost hundreds of Trump border walls? I mean, this thing, it would just be amazingly expensive. So how could it possibly be cost effective? And basically this is all, when I say they, it's all coming from husband and wife team, Scott and Julie Broussard. They are the inventors behind this whole idea. So now all of this was all 3 years ago, right? I mean, we talked about this 3 years ago. I can't believe it's been that long. But so what's the latest? I mean, they must have done some interesting things in all this time. It looks like they made the first public installation of this technology in Idaho. And when I heard that, I was hoping that they made something small, you know, like a mile stretch of solar road or something, you know, maybe a half mile or maybe 5 miles. That would be nice. I mean, that would be a great test. That ultimately, that's what you need to do. Make some road and see how it goes for at least a few years. But no, none of that happened. Basically, it looks like it was a tiny demo, a solar footpath thing that only had 30 of their famous SR3 panels. Only 30 of these panels, which is next to nothing. Uh-huh. I mean, they're all clustered together. I mean, calling it a footpath is kind of ridiculous, too. It's just kind of – the dimensions were pretty small.
It's a dance generation game, right?
That's what exactly. I was thinking.
Yeah, it's a variety.
They have to light up with different colors, right?
Oh, they better, Simon.
And they show some of these demo panels with all the different colors. So I guess that's something. So how well did it work, you may ask? Well, it didn't really work hardly at all. Listen to these stats.
No.
These stats are incredible. 18 of the 30 SR3 panels were broken when they arrived on the site. 18. And from what I could tell, they knew they were broken. They made the solar panels and then they kind of embedded them into this thick tempered glass material and baked them and stuff. And when they pulled them out of the ovens, They were like damaged. Most of them were damaged, wouldn't work, but they sent them anyway and installed them anyway. That in and of itself is just like, why are you doing this? Especially when we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars went into this installation, about $500,000, which makes me want to puke. So then you've got 18 out of 30 that are just dead on arrival. Then four more panels fail due to the rain. And you know, rain, that's that wet stuff that falls from the sky and lands on the road sometimes. That kind of knocked out four of them. So when it was all said and done, as far as I could tell, only five panels were lamely lighting up and you couldn't even see the light until 5 or 6 p.m. when it was dark enough so that the light could actually, you know, make it, you know, produce enough photons to outcompete all the other photons. It was ridiculous. So it's a quote from Next Big Future. They said on their website, the prototype appears to be plagued by drainage issues, poor manufacturing controls, and fundamental design flaws. And this is
other than
this
that.
Is six and a half years and $3.9 million later. They got a couple million dollars, I think $2.2 million from the campaign. Was it Indiegogo or what was it? Some campaign mm-hmm. that they
was
did.
Was it Kickstarter or Indiegogo?
Kickstarter. I see their names on Indiegogo websites, but I think it might have been Kickstarter, but one of those money raising websites. And they also got hundreds of thousands of dollars from like state and government grants and stuff. All of that stuff, and that's what they have. So I found a blog. There's an engineering blogger, Dave Jones. He's kind of semi-famous for disparaging the feasibility of this. His calculations show that the Solar Roadways SR3 panels should produce 35% of the energy of the power of residential rooftop panels. So the solar panels on your roof right now, Steve, are like three times better, more efficient than what these things can do. Three times. Even you know, there's other competitors too. In the Netherlands, there's some solar road company that's producing much cheaper solar panels meant for the road. Basically, you stick them on the road. That's it. You don't need anything. You just stick them on the existing road, and even they could only produce half the output of the rooftop panels that are on top of Steve's house right now. So they're not even close. None of this, I think, should be a surprise. I mean, you've got these road-based panels that they can't be angled, but pretty much by definition, they're not going to be able to angle them to track the sun, which is a big efficiency killer. And you've got to make them strong as hell, so that they're going to be buried within this thick, transparent material, to support all that weight. That's going to give it a hit too. So they're just like destined to not be very efficient. But
Bob, who knew that solar technology was so complicated?
Yeah.
I mean, who knew that? Nobody knew that.
Nobody knew that. We're discovering
it's as complicated
right
as healthcare. It's crazy.
Yeah, what the hell?
I know. And somebody came up with a power per installed cost, which I thought was interesting. So they looked at commercial residential solar panels. They came up with a little bit more than $2 per watt, or maybe a little bit less. Some of them were a little bit less than $2, which is pretty good. When they looked at these SR3 panels, they came up with like $44 per watt installed, but that doesn't even include maintenance and extra infrastructure and power transmission and drainage, any all that other good stuff. It doesn't even include that. So even the $44 per watt, 22 times the commercial residential stuff is still an underestimate because it's not including all this other stuff. So it's kind of pathetic. Even with the limitations, you'd think they'd have a little solar footpath that would actually work. And it does look like that they completely rushed it and didn't take it seriously. But I mean, after $3.9 million and 6.5 years, come on. It's really more pathetic than it even should have been.
You know, the obvious question here is, why aren't they giving up on this? You know, when
Jay,
will they give up?
You know
on
how
it,
human psychology it, works, man.
It's lucrative.
As long as people keep sending them money, they'll keep
yeah.
it.
I believe that they believe in this. They believe that this could work and it's really viable. But I think one of our takeaways from this type of technology was that sure, it could have some niche applications like your driveway. Your driveway doesn't take a lot of, a lot of damage. You don't have 18 wheelers going over the damn thing. It's, you know, you treat it much more gently than a common highway. So yeah, so maybe, you know, maybe you could put some of these on your driveway or potentially a parking lots. Maybe, I don't know, but I don't know. I think we should hit the low hanging fruit using the super efficient Steve panels on top of roofs. I mean, look what's happening with these solar panels on roofs now. They're making them so that it's actually cheaper to put them on your roof than, you know, when you're building from scratch, it's cheaper now to go solar than anything else. That's a no brainer. Why would you possibly not go solar? All new houses will soon, I think,
right,
all go solar, yeah, because yeah, it makes no sense not to. We're actually at that point.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's no point in reaching for this very tenuous technology when we haven't even picked the low-hanging fruit. And the solar roadways, I think, are never going to be a massive infrastructure thing, you know. Unless, again, there's got to be some unforeseen breakthrough in material science, right? That's always what it comes down to. With existing materials, existing technology, it's just not going to work, let alone be cost-effective. It has to not only work, but be cost-effective. Apparently, they are neither. So it's just, you know, just not going to work. Some ideas have to wait for other breakthroughs to happen, and they may never happen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what would it even take? I mean, I could conceive potentially if you could like lay down some super, like a thin, super strong layer that could then wirelessly transmit the power. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff you would need, stuff that we are just not even ready for yet. I mean, that's, you know, that could be many decades away before we have something cool like that.
All right, let's move on. We have another freak show to talk about. we haven't talked about the anti-vaccine movement in a while. There was an article published by a long-standing anti-vaccine crank, Kent Heckenlively.
Heckenlively.
Yeah, he's like he's at the crazy end of even the anti-vaccine spectrum. But what his article was, I thought, was interesting because it demonstrates quite nicely the rabbit hole that conspiracy theorists go down, right? They sort of dig themselves into this deep, dark hole that just keeps getting deeper, and there's really no way out. And he's essentially documenting that process, trying to explain, you know, where he is now. So it was just, you know, just him ranting about the evil, you know, cabal of drug company and doctors and the government who are poisoning children and won't listen to reason and don't care about anybody. So here's his premise, right? He sets up his premise. He writes, "We know that vaccines are causing massive damage," in all caps, "to the health of our young and contributing to the massive epidemics of chronic diseases among those of working age and the dementias of the elderly. Don't believe me? Just read the vaccine safety inserts." So prematurely arriving at a conclusion that actually you cannot support or defend is a very common symptom of pseudosciences, whether it's on the making a positive claim or the denialist end or conspiracy theories. They're always like, okay, we know this. Like, okay, we know ESP is real. So let's just all agree with that and start from that premise. It's like, no, that's actually the question at hand. It is not something, and that is, you know, to say it's controversial is being kind. It's actually the consensus is in the other direction. It's not even controversial. You know, so vaccines are one of the most studied interventions because they've been around for so long, and they're one of the safest, most effective, most cost-effective public health interventions that humanity has ever devised. And there is a rock-solid scientific consensus about their safety, which is not to say that there's no such thing as vaccine adverse effects or adverse events. Nobody denies that some people will have side effects or adverse reactions to vaccines. It's always about risk versus benefit. They're just rare. Serious adverse reactions are extremely rare at the 1 in a million level. And when you put that up against the benefit of vaccinations, the benefits win by orders of magnitude. And there's just no question about that. But Heckenlively and others in the anti-vaccine community, they disagree with scientists and experts. You know, there's an incredible, you know, hubris there that always strikes me. And I think, you know, you could, if you're being generous, say that they're just not really thinking about it, that they're being thoughtless. But if you think about it for just a second, there's a difference between their interpretation of the science as non-experts. This guy's not even a scientist. He's not a scientist. He doesn't know how to read the literature, understand technical studies. He doesn't even know how the package inserts are made. Right? Package inserts include everything that's reported about a drug, whether they think it's real or not. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are taking the drug and you said, oh, I got a headache, then headache gets listed in the package insert as a reported side effect. It errs on the side of reporting everything, which is fine, as long as you weren't. But he's saying, look at all these things. He's not looking at the rate that these things occur or whether the evidence supports that there's actually a causal effect. It
doesn't matter.
Read the package insert. So it's just confirmation bias from – but he puts his uninformed misreading of whatever is out there of studies of the package insert up against the opinion of experts and scientists who disagree with him. Now, he doesn't conclude from that – which I think any reasonable person who is expressing a rational level of humility that, I disagree with the experts, there must be something wrong with my understanding of the science then. I should try to find out from them what's really going on and why I'm wrong. Clearly my knowledge is either flawed or incomplete in some way because all the experts disagree with me. No, he doesn't conclude that. He concludes that he's right. And all the so-called experts are evil Nazi lying scumbags. That's what he concludes. Mm-hmm. Think about
now. We're sure they're not, right, Steve?
Well, I mean, I'm one of them, so I'm pretty confident I'm not an evil Evan. Nazi.
Yeah,
but you do eat babies.
Yeah. Well, that's what it leads to. That it leads to calling them Nazis and saying they should be killed, and you know,
right.
You know, photoshopping pictures of them eating babies because – so that's the dark path that they go down. Like once you think, all right, they're saying that vaccines are safe, but I know that it's causing massive damage. You see it. It's all around you. You can see it, right? So once you start with that premise, it's unavoidable. You have to conclude, well, if I know that I'm right and I'm taking that as a rock solid premise – and the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, disagrees with me. They're saying something different. They must be part of a conspiracy.
Yep.
And then it just goes from there. It's like, well, what about all the doctors doing the actual research? Well, they're in on it too. And what about
they make a lot of money.
The thousand – they actually don't. You don't make money giving people vaccines. That's a money
loser. I understand that, but that's part of their right.
Yeah, well, yeah. I hear what you're saying. Just to be clear to the people listening to it, they will say it's all about money. It's all about money. Vaccines are not a big money maker for pharmaceutical companies. They're not a money maker for physicians. But once you think that, all right, so the CDC itself is corrupt. Well, then the government is corrupt. And then all physicians basically are anybody who could know any differently. And then science communicators, if someone is saying, hey, you know, I kind of looked over the information here and, you know, every major scientific and health organization in the world says that vaccines are safe. Well, then you're a shill. You're part of the cover up yourself.
Yep.
So it just keeps, conspiracy theories have to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And Heckenlively can't figure out why the world isn't listening to him. He just can't figure it out. So he even says that makes him more and more cynical. He writes, but I thought when people like me raised our voices and claimed vaccines were harming the human species that somebody in a position of authority in government or science would do some proper investigation.
Oh, my God. As if there haven't been a million studies.
He says, however, I had to confront some dark truths about the corruption of the American body politic. But then he goes on. Now, no matter how cynical I was about whether people in our government cared about children with autism and the wholesale destruction of our species by vaccines, I wasn't cynical enough. We tried to work with our health authorities. They turned a deaf ear. So again, at no point does he think maybe I'm wrong here. Maybe, you know, people aren't listening. They're not, I'm not being persuasive. Instead, he just gets more and more cynical. The conspiracy gets darker and deeper and broader. People aren't listening because they don't care. You know, he actually thinks that doctors are standing by watching the quote unquote wholesale destruction of our species by vaccines. And we just don't care. And, you know, hey, that doesn't matter.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
Heartless.
You know, and Steve, I think one way to look at this is sometimes it's a slow indoctrination, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's you don't wake up and you're a conspiracy theorist in one day. You know, I mean, I'm sure some people have a propensity to go that way. But I think a lot of times you have like this slow burn. They're talking to other people that are, yeah, that are fully indoctrinated. They're getting more and more information or misinformation.
Yeah, it's more like a long-term erosion.
Yeah, and then, you know, you get your emotions start to significantly engage.
Yep.
And there's a tipping point because,
yeah,
most people can see the flaws in this thinking and be, you know, dissuaded by real information or by talking to an expert. But today, you know, we're seeing this magnificent, you know, great but not good slide towards misinformation and people just disregarding experts and having, yeah, a lack of respect for science and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And it's utterly, mm-hmm, frightening because it's like watching this train wreck in slow motion.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you're just like, you just know it's going to happen. You know that we're going to hit a bad wall if this keeps up.
It's interesting to see where it's going to go. But so he, and to that point, Jay, he favorably references Alex Jones and InfoWars.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
There's something to discount you right off the bat.
Oh, absolutely. So Alex Jones, you know, InfoWars is like the most insane conspiracy outlet that there is. I mean, Alex Jones claimed at one point
9/11 truther. He's among.
Forget about that, Evan. Forget that. Barack Obama is a literal demon. He's literally a demon.
He's at that wall. He's literally at the wall of that of the spectrum.
I shouldn't have voted for him then.
Yeah, so that's the echo chamber. They have their own sources of information, their own sources of news. It doesn't matter how crazy it is. It's all, you know, and there's this crank magnetism as well. So like Moms Against Monsanto, they're also anti-vaccine and anti-fluoridation. So they're all sort of going together as a package. And they think that doctors are lying to people about cancer and chemotherapy. It's all together, right? Because once you accept the dark conspiracy, once you're willing to believe that doctors are evil and the government's trying to kill you, and only, you know, the corporations with money control everything, then there is no limit to what you will believe. And then he gets to like the really dark place, even darker still at the end, which we've already seen before. But he writes, "I wish I could say I felt sorry for those who will suffer the wrath of an enraged public when all of this is revealed. But I don't. When the Nazis lost World War II, many of them used a rat line to escape to South America. For these criminals, that's us, there will be no, mm-hmm, place in the world which will accept them." So that's a part of this as well. There's this fantasizing about this future reckoning when the people who disagree with you will be finally be revealed and people will finally believe you. And then they will be worse than Nazis. And then the anti-vaxxers can stand over them gloating while the mobs that they helped incite tear their enemies to pieces and they won't feel sorry because,
wow,
they deserve it. And
beyond bizarre.
Yeah. So it gets really scary, dangerous when it gets to that level. He's like totally through the looking glass, right? This is it. This is now an alternate reality. He's part of the Army of Light. If you disagree with him, you're a Nazi and he has no sympathy for you whatsoever. That's where the anti-vaccine movement is. And that's like the core of the anti-vaccine movement. This is, you know, this guy, yeah, maybe he's a little bit out to one side, but not by much. This is, he's one of the people that the anti-vaxxers are listening to. This is like Mike Adams, you know, putting together his Hitler hit list of science communicators who are like, yeah, you know, GMOs are actually fine. You know, this hysteria over GMOs is not really science-based. And he's like, yep, they should be killed just like, you know, Nazis. That's where they are. That's where they are. It's really scary. So we need to keep exposing it. We just need to keep exposing this to the light of day and examining. Just try to, you know, got to inoculate people because this is like a cult. And once you're in the cult, as you say, Jay, it's a slow burn. That's like, they don't tell you on day one, oh yeah, Xenu and the Thetans are like the dead spirits. They don't tell you all that shit on day one. They bring you in little by little. Well, we just, you know, think that we need a little bit more research to ensure that vaccines are safe. And then they're Nazis. They need to be killed. You know, that's where it ends up. But it's this, it's a continuous dark path in that direction. And we need to understand that. And the thing is, here's the thing. I do have sympathy for people who get caught up in this because, you know, in a way, they're a victim of this flaw in the programming of the human brain. That's how I see it. They're stuck in a feedback loop of confirmation bias and motivated reasoning and conspiracy thinking. And if you're not aware of these things and how they function, if you don't have the critical thinking chops to recognize it, you get sucked in hard.
You can't pull yourself
out. And then the thing is, conspiracy theories are really good at inoculating people, ironically, against getting out of the conspiracy theory, because, you know, any evidence is a false flag, right? Or it's a lie. Any evidence that's missing is a cover up. There's no way out. It's a completely self-contained belief system. And I have nothing but sympathy for people who find themselves into it. I'm not trying to, you know, blame the victim here, but we do have to, however, target the people who are mainly promoting it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they are leading people down this path, and it's a dark path. All right, Evan, I understand that fast radio bursts might be evidence of alien life.
Isn't that a fascinating idea?
Sort of.
I think it's I just said the idea is fascinating.
I'm not impressed, but tell us what's going on.
Well, it comes to us courtesy of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And the headline of their news article reads, "Could fast radio bursts be powering alien probes?" And it's outlined in a new research paper by theorists Avi Loeb and Manasvi Lingam.
You mean like anal probes? I don't understand.
Loeb said, here's what he said, main quote from the article, "Fast radio bursts are exceedingly bright given their short duration and origin at great distances, and we haven't identified a possible natural source with any confidence. An artificial origin is worth contemplating and checking." Yes, we've talked about fast radio bursts before on the show. Here's a quick refresher on what they are. Fast radio bursts, FRBs for short. Fast, well, because they're blips, they're very short, less than 5 milliseconds in duration, and that is less than 1/200th of a second. That is fast. Radio, because the emissions are radio wavelength and detected by radio telescopes covering a broad range of frequencies, hence radio. And bursts, because, well, they're bursts. The signals disappear as quickly as they appear without warning and so far without explanation. Okay, so what makes these special? Aren't there things all over the sky that, you know, burst and radiate and go fast? Well, sure, but here's what's special about these. FRBs occur irregularly. So it's not a process like something rotating at a constant rate, say a pulsar or other things that we've identified that you can attach a measurement to. Second, some FRBs have repeated in the same location in the sky. That's significant because it indicates that a non-cataclysmic event is sort of taking place, you know, as opposed to the destruction of, say, colliding black holes, something to that effect, and you can only get that once at any point in the sky. Sometimes they repeat. So here you've got this random, repeatable, very powerful event occurring, well, throughout the universe. We know that because we've measured them, and they're not just occurring upon our galactic plane from our point of view on Earth. All over the sky.
They're isotropic. I learned that from
isotropic.
Kara.
Yay.
Yeah.
Yay.
Thank you, Kara.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Kara.
I knew that word years before I knew Kara.
Good for you, Bob. Good for you.
Proud of you.
And there have been, well, 21 recorded. That's it. We know of 21 times astronomers have been able to measure an FRB. So when you have a theorist suggesting that artificial origins can't be ruled out, that gets a lot of attention by both the public and professionals as well. In the paper, Loeb and Lingam asked three questions, essentially. First, how much energy would it take to create a device to produce an FRB? Answer, they calculate that you would need to harvest all of the sunlight from a star, say, equivalent to our sun radiating its energy onto a planet twice the size of Earth, that equivalence.
And I assume they mean twice the surface area.
Twice the surface area of Earth, I suppose,
Over and how much time?
I don't have a number on that, Bob, specifically.
To me, that's the key information. I mean, that's absolutely key. I mean, is the energy building up over a second, a year, a month, that to me, that's all that matters. I read Steve's blog too, and he didn't have that in there either.
I didn't find it. I didn't find that information.
Otherwise, the sun, the earth is meaningless.
No, I agree, but it was not in the Harvard Smithsonian write up of it.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't. But what they're trying to, this is size wise, it's large, very, very large. So it gives you a little sense, huge, say, of the scale of the sizes we're talking about. Their second question they posed, could such a machine so capable withstand the waste heat? Would it literally melt itself away before being able to fulfill its actual purpose? Well, the theorists calculate that such a machine could feasibly be water cooled and would not necessarily melt. That is assuming you had a cooling device two times bigger than the size of the Earth. Again, size. Don't exactly elaborate on how that mechanism would work, but again, they're saying that you don't have to break the laws of physics in order to extrapolate that. Their third question is, well, why build such a device? Why would an intelligent civilization do this? And here's where the alien probes part comes in. They argue that the most plausible use of such power is driving interstellar light sails. The amount of power involved would be sufficient to push a payload of 1 million tons, or about 20 times the largest cruise ships on Earth. Now, Loeb admits that the work is speculative, obviously, and when asked whether he really believes that any fast radio bursts are due to aliens, he replied, "Science isn't a matter of belief, it's a matter of evidence. Deciding what's likely ahead of time limits the possibilities. It's worth putting ideas out there and letting the data be the judge."
So listen, but yeah, let's be clear. This is not evidence. This paper does not in any way support this hypothesis. This was a very thin feasibility study. They just wanted to say, could a technological civilization harness enough energy to do this? You know, would it break the laws of physics? Would it, a device that could do this, melt under its own waste heat? All they could say is, in their limited analysis, it doesn't appear to break the laws of physics. Okay. That's not, you know, a lot. That's pretty thin. It certainly isn't evidence that they are alien. So, Bob, to follow up on your question, this is something else, that this is a press release, you know, released by the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and they say that the paper has been accepted for publication, but it hasn't been published yet. So we don't have access to the paper to look for those kind of details. And you have to question, well, why put out the press release before it's published?
Yeah, that's kind of unethical, I think.
I think it's dubious because then we can't answer these questions. You know, I can't check their math, examine the people. There's no comment from other physicists or anything. It's just, you know, here it is. But the most important thing to point out with this is that this is a pattern that whenever astronomers find a phenomenon that they can't explain, somebody asks, is it aliens? Right? For everything, every time. And so far.
Could it be Satan?
Yeah. Could it be aliens? So. That was, remember Little Green Men, right? Pulsars.
That's right. LGMs.
And remember the planet that the light is dipping by 20%? We have no idea. Could it be an alien megastructure? So this happens every time. And the answer is no. The universe is a huge place. There's lots of stuff we haven't discovered yet. There's lots of rare events. I did a quickie calculation on this. So if an event happens once every million galaxies, once every million years, right? So this event will happen in 1 in a million galaxies every million years. That's still 2 events a year in the universe. And if we could see the whole – in the visible universe, and of course we could see by definition the visible universe, if we're looking for such events, we'll still see 2 a year, even though it's – That's rare as shit. Yeah, so really rare shit. We'll still see it on a regular basis. And that's about how often these FRBs are happening, right? Maybe more frequently than that, but it's on that level, right? We're seeing them. We've seen 17 in the last whatever. How long has it been? 10 years.
Yeah.
So and that's, by the way, that's based on a new estimate. I can't remember if we talked about this or not. The new estimate for the number of galaxies in the visible universe. You guys know how many?
I think we did.
Yeah. Remember, it's 2 trillion. We're up to 2
it's
trillion.
Trillions.
Yeah. 2 wow. trillion galaxies in the visible universe. So, yeah, big freaking place. So, okay, yeah, it's obviously we love this sort of thing. It's fun to think about. It's fun to think about the feasibility, think about the Dyson swarm or whatever causing mm-hmm. the I hope it turns out to be something cool like that. That'll be fascinating. But we do have to temper our enthusiasm for thinking about aliens in this context with the history has been so far aliens, zero. There hasn't been one
right.
of these astronomical phenomena that's turned out to be aliens.
Is the most compelling part of this idea, though, is that the irregular occurrences of FRBs, does that lend any kind
no.
of little extra teeth to
it? No, I don't think so. No. Not at all. In fact, that makes it, to me, makes it less plausible. So what alien civilization is using this? Why aren't they using it all the time? Why isn't it all coming from one galaxy where they have
right.
where they're set up to use it? Why is it all over the visible universe spread yep. throughout history? You know, 1 billion years ago, 2 billion years ago.
Right. So all these different civilizations, super advanced civilizations all throughout the history of the universe are using a similar technology, you know, to propel these light sails or whatever. To me, the frequency and the you know, the fact that it's so dispersed to me means it's a natural phenomenon. We just yeah. don't know enough about it yet. That's
exactly.
it. I mean, to me, it's like, seems like a no brainer.
Oh, yeah. I'm not holding my breath on this one. All right. Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
All right. So last week I played This Noisy. Wow. What is that?
I like it. I don't know. It's dark. It's pretty.
It. It's a musical instrument.
Theremin.
Okay. Theremin.
It's called the Yaibahar or Yaibahar. Yaibahar. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I think that's how you have to say it. You have to kind of sing it. Yaibahar. So, very cool. Very weird. I said that you've heard it before. You probably have heard this in movies because of how odd it is. Yeah, this is akin to like a water phone. You look it up if you've never heard one. You've heard them in the movies again. But water phone is definitely like a horror movie type of sound that we've all heard a million times, video games and everything. Well, this is very similar to that. Very cool instrument. So very quickly, it's two springs attached to two different drum heads. And the instrument itself has strings on it that vibrates the whole thing. And it makes this wonderful, you know, intensely reverb, deep reverb type of sound. I'm playing a very small piece of music that the man who created this instrument made, and it's beautiful, and it goes into very interesting places. Let me tell you what the person that sent it in, Bert Van Ketz, said. The first time I heard the Yaibahar, I could not believe it wasn't an electronic instrument. This snare string instrument is supposedly used in many sci-fi movies. And then I had somebody else give me some fantastic information, and this is the winner for this week's Noisy. This is Brian Personal, and if that's his real last name, it's interesting. He said, Jay, this week's Noisy is a Turkish acoustic instrument called a Yaibahar, or it is a thunder machine. The Yaibahar has two asymmetrical drums connected by leather straps or skinny springs to a two- or three-string cello-like instrument. There are no electronic or post-production effects. The reverb and echo are caused by the two drums and the straps connected to them. Unbelievably cool, very weird-looking instrument. Now, a lot of people wrote in and guessed that this was a steel cable that was, you know, being pulled very tightly, very similar to the sound effects that created the blaster for Star Wars, which
yeah,
is
yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is what that sure. sounds like.
Yeah, I had okay. that same vibe.
Yeah, that is that's wrong. Everyone, I wrote in. Sorry, it's wrong. You already know that. But it's an interesting thing because your brain is going to a similar place because you're hearing that when a steel cable is struck by something hard, like, you know, like a wrench or something, and if it's under the right tension, you're going to get this back and forth motion from the sound slash waves of energy that are going through the rod or the cable. So it is very similar, and I thought it was fascinating that, you know, 20 or 30 people wrote in all saying that that's what it was. So when Ben Burke created
the sound effects for movie 4 for Star Wars, which was the original Star Wars movie. He used that sound that he got out of the cable, that steel cable. He used it for virtually every blaster sound that Star Wars used. It was the beginning of everything, and he morphed it to become all these different sounds, which I think is so cool. So thank you all. That was pretty cool. I have a new noisy. It's interesting. That noisy was sent in by a listener named Lad Avron.
It's a bird. Neat.
Very cool.
Yeah, birdish.
Very cool noisy this week, guys. Good luck. If you heard a cool noisy this week, or you want to guess about what this noisy is this week, email me, please, at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, thanks, Jay. So just series of emails, actually. So as is often the case, whenever we talk about something extremely superficial, it garners the most interest and feedback. So our sort of pre-show chat about coffee and tea last week garnered by far the most feedback of anything we talked about on the show last week, which is interesting. But it is, you know, it's something that a lot of people drink either tea or coffee. And, you know, we deal with all of these issues. So I wasn't surprised, actually. So I'm not going to pick out any one email. I'm going to sort of summarize the feedback that we got and mention a couple of follow-up points. So there was a few themes to the emails. One theme was that Australians think that they have the best coffee in the world, and they laugh at Americans whenever we talk about our coffee. Another theme was that the British think they have the best tea in the world, and they laugh at Americans whenever we talk about making tea or anything to do with tea.
I buy that one. I don't buy the first one.
You know,
I thought Colombians have the best coffee.
In my experience.
Or Hawaiians and Colombians. Really? Australian coffee? Or at least that's not a thing here.
I think they're talking about how they prepare it, not necessarily
growing
the beans.
Gotcha. Like they're the biggest coffee snobs.
They know how to make it. Yeah,
I see. Okay.
So,
but their cups are so tiny. You order a large and it's like a tiny little eye cup.
But they do drink a lot of what? They drink flat whites, and that finally made it over to the States.
Oh, yeah. Flat whites.
That's true.
Yeah, and a couple people said the only way to make coffee is with an espresso machine. You have to use the pressure to whatever. Anything short of that.
Us non-coffee drinkers, right.
So multiple people wrote in with a very interesting fact. We talked about green tea versus black tea. Etc. And they pointed out that all teas actually come from the same species, the same plant, Camellia sinensis. There's actually two varieties.
What?
There's Camellia sinensis and Camellia sinensis assamica, but they're basically the same species.
No way.
And white tea, yellow tea, green tea, oolong tea, and black tea all come from the same plant. The only difference is the processing. They're processed to attain varying levels of oxidation, and that's the only difference.
So without that one plant, we would not have tea.
We would have only herbal tea and, of course, as I learned from all the emails, rooibos.
Rooibos, yeah.
Yeah, not rooibos, like I've been pronouncing it.
Rooibos.
Because that comes from an Afrikaans word.
Yeah, so it's South African. That's the word literally means red bush. Yeah, that's their quote-unquote tea. Some people definitely insisted that only tea from the tea plant be called tea and everything else is something else. But yeah, just using herbal tea just means it's not really tea. It's just an herbal infusion that you drink like tea. Fine. I don't see a problem with that. So the other interesting couple of people mentioned, which I totally agree with, they said, how do you know – unless you do a controlled experiment, like a blinded experiment, how do you know you could really tell the difference between different methods of preparing coffee and tea? And we have to agree with that point because we know that when tested in a blinded condition, wine experts couldn't tell the difference between different types of wine.
That's so good that they have all that training as sommeliers.
So
they got red confused with white.
That's hilarious.
They got the basics.
Well, if you put red food coloring in white wine, people then describe it in terms that are associated with red wine. They taste it as if it's a red wine, even though it's a white wine with food coloring in it. So given that research, we have to acknowledge that unless we do a blinded test, we can't know if our perception is – if the difference is perceivable.
Subjective, yeah.
Or if it's just we like doing the process and it makes us think it's better. Mm-hmm. So I tried to find if the wine experiment was replicated with tea or coffee, and I could not find any example in published research. So if anyone knows of any – we'll crowdsource this. Send it our way.
I'm going to answer the. I'm going to answer this for you, Steve.
Well, in the meantime, I think it would be fun if we have time. Maybe we can do our own blinded test.
Sure.
But it would be cool to compare, for example, Steve, you and me, because we have done genetic testing to know that we are super tasters versus individuals who are not super tasters, to see if there's a difference between them as well.
Right, because I'm very sensitive to bitter tastes.
Me too.
Sensitive. Yeah.
My point is I'm going for what I personally find tasting better. I'm not trying to like determine – you know, which one is which, or like, you know, is this a South American bean or whatever? I'm not doing that. I'm just saying, hey, this tastes better than that. And then.
Yeah, but it's not blind to you.
Subjective.
You know what you did in order to make the coffee the way you made it. So you have all of these emotional investments in one of them tasting better than the other. It's like impossible.
It's just just expectation.
Yeah,
just
take
expectation.
That out. Yeah.
You can't disregard the process influencing.
Too many biases.
Too much personal bias.
It's like audio cables. People can't tell the difference between audio cables, but they think they can.
Right.
But they think
I mean, look, let me give you a specific example. If I make a cup of Keurig, I've done this, and I make a cup of, you know, back in the time when I did this, it wasn't a pour over. It was just me, you know, using my brewer. You know, I'm like, okay, this tastes better than that. I didn't have a reason to hate the Keurig. It just, that's what made me good away from it, as I had good coffee. And I'm like, whoa. Then, you know, I went to my brother-in-law's house and he lined up like 4 cups of coffee for me, made in different processes, and just said, which one of these do you like best?
So you did a pseudo blind taste test.
Yeah.
That was interesting.
But
did you choose did you choose the civet coffee?
No, that's disgusting. But they, the civet coffee is they harvest beans that have passed through a civet's digestive tract.
So, I mean, I think it's certainly plausible that there is perceivable differences in different kinds of coffee prepared differently. I certainly, even though I don't drink it, I could smell it. Like for a while, my wife was using this one type of coffee in the Keurig that was like really awful. I couldn't stand the smell of it. Now I'm much better. But some coffee, even though I don't drink it, I could say, okay, that smells okay. That smells good. So there's definitely a huge range there. But you can't know the effect of individual things that you're doing. Like, is the 3 minutes or the 205 versus the 195? You can't really know unless you did a fairly significant blind test to see. Because it would be interesting to see if we could nail down which variables actually matter.
Well, you might be able to use mass spec. You know, there might be an interesting thing where you just look at how the concentration of tannins in the tea, for example, after you've brewed it at different temperatures. That might be a cool scientific way. It doesn't have anything to do with taste. It's a translatable thing. But
that science is probably out there. I just, the time I had for the show this week, my Google chops couldn't find it. But it might be more in the deep web where you have to know where to look for it, you know, to find it. But anyway, again, if anybody does know of any published research that would inform this question, I'd love to see it. But yeah, as a matter of principle, unless you're blinded, you can't really make firm statements about.
And even then, you need so many participants because people have different tastes.
You need a robust study.
Yeah.
Robust.
Yeah. It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Just 3 regular news items this week. Here we go. Item number 1. A major review of climate change research finds that there is significant publication bias favoring positive studies. Item number two, scientists report that for the first time they were able to change adult skin cells into neural stem cells without making any genetic changes. And item number three, a newly published estimate concludes that worldwide spiders consume between 400 and 800 million tons of insects and other invertebrates each year. Kara, go first.
Here we go. A major review of climate change research finds that there is significant publication bias favoring positive studies. Is a positive climate change study? This is like the trope in a TV show when somebody finds out that their HIV results are negative and they get depressed. Is a positive climate change study one that shows that climate change is happening?
Yes, yes.
Okay, all right. Okay, a bias favoring positive studies. God, I hope that's not true because that's going to give deniers a lot of ammunition. Scientists report that for the first time, they're able to change adult skin cells into neural stem cells without making any genetic changes. I am going to say that one is science for reasons I will not tell the other rogues so as not to change their outcomes. And the reason is not that I read it, by the way. It's for neuro reasons. And a newly published estimate concludes that worldwide spiders consume between 400 and 800 million tons of insects and other. I mean, spiders have a massive biomass. I have a really hard time, as most people do, when we get into the like these quantities of numbers. Shitloads of spiders probably eat a shitload of insects. So I'm going to say that that one's science. So I guess by default, I'm going to say that the climate change one is the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Well, okay. So this first one about the climate change bias. So I think, I don't know. I mean, Kara, it does kind of make sense. I can see that there would be bias in publish what they choose to publish. I mean, it seems like perfect for human error and motivated reasoning and all that stuff. But I will take into serious counsel the fact that you chose that as the fake. The second one about the scientists were able to change adult skin cells into neural stem cells. What the hell? That is awesome. Interesting. And something sounds strangely familiar about that. And I could see this happening. I agree with Kara on this as well, that this doesn't seem that out there. And the last one about the spiders. Yeah, I mean, that one is science to me. Spiders, you know, they without a doubt, they're consuming tons of bugs and whatever they can get their grubby eight little legs on. They're going to eat, suck the essential oils and juices out of them.
That's why I keep them in my house.
Yeah. I never kill spiders in my house.
Nope.
They can hang out. They can do what they want.
I have never, ever killed a spider, ever.
They just can't sit in my chair, and that's it.
Or in my bed.
Right.
Or hang in my face when I'm driving.
Or crawl in my underwear.
Like they do. Yeah.
Again.
Not that that's ever happened.
Okay, I'm going to go with Kara here and say that the first one about the positive study bias in publishing.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I mean, this one, at the first glance, I was like, crap, I didn't read any of this stuff. Where the hell is Steve getting this shit? But as they're sinking in, it does seem pretty clear. The spider one, yeah, I mean, I've loved spiders ever since I read Charlotte's Web when I was like, shit, how old was I? 8, 9? Totally into spiders. I've always said many times, without spiders, insects would take over the world, and they pretty much would. So, yeah, I mean, 400 to 800 million tons. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like that's a big number. But, you know, I don't think it's going to be significantly different from that. I guess it could conceivably be, you know, much bigger than that. You know, 2 billion tons. Who the hell knows? That wouldn't shock me either. But that's about right. That sounds like it's in the ballpark. The neural stem cells. Yeah, I could buy that one. And, of course, Kara's confidence is swaying me on this one a little bit as well. But the first one, that one's kind of rubbed me wrong from the get-go. First off, publication bias I could see, but significant publication bias kind of bothers me that would be possible. And secondly, how many negative climate studies actually have there been? Probably not too many. So how the hell are you going to show bias if, I mean, it's clearly happening. It's like, oh, there's a bias towards showing that evolution, positive evolution studies. Well, yeah, how many negative ones really are there? So for all those reasons, I'm going to say that's fiction.
And Evan.
That's a very good point, Bob. You know, what is it, the consensus now for climate change, 97% and probably growing among scientists. So I think in this one, you'd have to say that it would be something akin to 97% of the publications about climate change, you know, in some way are wrong. It's just not, it's too much. It's the evidence is so overwhelming. As Bob said, it would be really, really tough to think that this one is anything but the fiction. Therefore, the other two have to be science. This has to be the fiction.
All right. So someone's going to get swept this week.
Right. That's right, man.
Is it going to be me?
The broom.
Be the first sweep of the year, or am I going to sweep you guys? Well, since you all chose the first one, we'll take this in reverse order. A newly published estimate concludes that worldwide, spiders consume between 400 and 800 million tons of insects and other invertebrates each year. You all think this one is science. Remember my order of magnitude rule, which would mean that if this were the fiction, it would be 40 to 80 million. What if I said 40 to 80 million tons? That's a big number, too. Would you buy that? What if I said...
I don't know.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. What if I said 4 to 8 billion tons?
It sounds a little... It sounds low to me, but who the hell knows?
There's a ton of insects and spiders and everything else out there.
Billions of tons.
Billions I would buy.
You'd buy billions?
I don't know.
A billion tons? It's only 200 million more than the upper echelon here, the upper
number. True.
That's, you know, it's damn close to a billion tons.
40 billion.
Metric tons or the other kind?
And what if you said gigaton?
These are metric tons. These are million metric tons. Yeah.
Teratons.
Not that that matters.
Teratons.
Gigatons.
You'd lose me. Petatons.
This one.
Zetatons.
Is science. This is science.
Yay.
Of course it is.
Yeah. This is an easy one, but I just literally couldn't find anything. I was like, shit, I got to use the damn spiders.
Plus, that's a big range. Plus, that's a pretty big range, 400 to 800. There's a lot of wiggle room in there.
It's only a factor of two. That's about right for these kind of estimates. Think about it. How could they know? You know, so they count up the number of spiders. They figure out how much the spiders eat.
Interviews.
They assume what their feeding schedule is. You know, so from limit, they reviewed the literature looking at, you know, different estimates, and then they came up with this updated estimate of how much they're eating. This is about 1% of all the insects in the world, what they're eating. Most of this 1%. Is in the forests and, like, prairies is where most of the 95% of the spider-consuming insects is occurring. They are definitely important. They are important predators on insects. If there weren't for spiders, there would be a lot more of them. Insects have other important predators as well, like bats and birds, for example. Spiders are a major contributor. And spiders also are prey. They are eaten by birds, for example, and other predators. So they're right there in the middle of the food chain. And I agree. I would not remove. I just let spiders be. Let them do whatever they want. Eat the bugs. But my daughters freak out when they see a spider. They want me to get rid of it. And I say, all right, what would you rather have in your house? One spider or 1,000 bugs?
Yep.
Take your pick.
Yep.
To let the spiders.
Especially
do
mosquitoes.
Stuff. Yeah. Let them eat.
Screw
them eat the
mosquitoes.
Bugs. Leave them alone.
And also termites. There's spiders that keep the termites from getting in, which is nice.
Yeah, spiders are cool. There are only two venomous spiders in Connecticut where we live.
What do you have?
We have
Black Widow.
Brown Recluse.
And the Brown Recluse. That's it. So
you don't have Brown Widows.
Black
Widow, Brown Recluse. So if you can recognize those two spiders, if it's not one of those two spiders, just don't worry about them.
In California, I wonder how many more we have, but we definitely have Brown Widows, which are not native, and they have pushed out the Black Widows a lot of places.
Brown
Widows. So I've got Brown Widows all over my house. I let them hang out. They are also venomous, but they have been shown to be much less quote-unquote aggressive. It's less likely that you'll get bitten by a Brown Widow, so I'm fine with them. They live, I actually have Brown Widows that live in my entryway. I like it when they set up a nest right next to the front door. But we have a lot of things. Let's see. Brown recluse, California trapdoor spider, long-legged sack spider, yellow sack spider. Oh, California.
Trapdoors are cool.
I've never seen a black widow or a brown recluse in the wild. I've only seen them, you know, in
zoos. Me neither.
Zoos,
decades of living in Connecticut.
I've seen I've seen like one or two Black Widows, but for every one Black Widow I've seen, I've probably seen 50 Brown Widows. Like, wow. There's a ton of Brown Widows.
It's the one you don't see that you got to worry about.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's always right behind you.
Or guys, in your shoe, you know.
As cool as our spiders are, though, remember Australia? We were like walking through the woods, like, holy crap. Look at a big spider in a big, beautiful web. They were just magnificent.
Huge. Hunter spiders? Massive. I don't think I could convince my daughters to allow a hunter spider to set up shop in our house.
I've seen some wolf spiders in Connecticut that have been pretty damn big.
Okay, let's move on to number two. Scientists report that, for the first time, they were able to change adult skin cells into neural stem cells without making any genetic changes. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Ooh,
yay!
Congratulations to everyone.
Yay! Woohoo!
Yeah, so the new bit
they're both
here.
Ectoderm.
They changed to neural crest cells. Mm-hmm. And the new bit here is that they didn't make any genetic changes. They didn't have to, you know, insert a gene or silence a gene or whatever, which is previously what they've had to do to convert adult cells into stem cells. Here they just did something. They're not saying exactly what they did to it, but
they're not even saying, bastards.
Proprietary.
But they did some just processing, and this was like the result of a 5 years of just continuous research trying to work this out. Yeah, they said this was a Herculean effort, but they finally were able to do it.
That's fantastic. So what's for economy of scale? I mean, to scale this up to huge vats of stem cells, neural stem cells?
Sure. I mean, think of it. This is amazing in terms of the potential, you know, because they could just take, you know, scraping of your skin cells. And they could grow them, right? And then they could change them all into neural stem cells and then use them for research or hopefully one day for therapeutic interventions. And they'll be your cells, right? So no rejection or anything like that.
And it's so easy to donate skin cells.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can they implant them into my head and make me smarter?
Well, I mean, obviously the goal is to eventually be able to do that, to inject them into some part of your nervous system and cure diseases. But so I think at this point, sort of my summary of where we are with all this is we're really good at harvesting and making stem cells. We're there. We can freaking make brain stem cells out of skin cells now, right? We're there. The problem is using them, right? Is getting them to do therapeutically what we want them to do without them causing cancer, you know, just growing into tumors. But we want them to survive. We don't want them to die. They need to take up shop, but we don't want them to generate cancer. There's a reason why we don't just regenerate everything, right? There's no reason why we couldn't just have stem cells everywhere just already that could regenerate any damage. The problem is they cause cancer. It's always a balance between having the ability to heal and regenerate without growing tumors. And you know, every species has sort of found their own balance for how long they live, et cetera. And different tissues have their own balance. You know, some tissues regenerate more than others. And so we're changing that. You know, we're changing what's already kind of evolved to an optimal balance. It's not going to be easy. And we're finding that application to be extremely challenging. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen. You know, it just means it's going to take longer than we thought. And like a lot of complicated, right? Who knew stem cells were so complicated?
How does Wolverine – why isn't he just one big fat cancerous tumor?
Yeah, because he's magic. That's why I don't have to worry about stuff like science.
No, it's not magic. Awesome. He's a mutant, Steve.
Yeah, where does
– Factor X, Steve.
It is. It's magic. So – yeah, so some genetic change is going to enable you to harness fantastical energies from where?
The solar system, Steve.
Where's
that's right.
Eating lots of Whoppers.
Just calculate how much energy is coming out of Cyclops' eye. Eyes. Where's that energy coming from? Anyway.
Yeah, that's Cyclops, though. Come on.
You just have to believe, Steve.
Yeah, Steve.
They must have, like, matter, antimatter, you know, converting energy in some kind of new organelle that they're making or something.
That's right. It's like a coil inside of the old televisions that used to build up to whatever volts and generate the pig. It's like that.
They need some kind of mutant mitochondria that generates literally orders of magnitude more energy than our biological.
Yeah, but then that's when you get into the whole midichlorians,
exactly.
Mindy, what? What were you saying? What were those?
Yeah,
midichlorians from.
It's not a real word.
From episodes 1, 2, and 3 with Jar Jar Binks.
Episodes what?
One yeah, Star Wars with Jar Jar Binks.
Jay did the the alien. What movie was that? Where they flashed the thing in your eyes?
Oh, Men in Black.
He did the Men in Black treatment right. after he saw this.
Look here.
Yeah, let's stop. Let's ignore that, Jay.
All of this means that a major review of climate change research finds that there is significant publication bias favoring positive studies is the fiction. Although, Bob, I do disagree with your characterization. You said, where are the negative studies? That's the point, right? If there were publication bias, you wouldn't see the negative studies because they're getting filtered out at the publication level. But it's not true. There was a major review of.
I think you missed my point though, Steve. I mean, my point was that climate change is real, and there wouldn't even be many before the level.
You're missing my point. If they did find there was publication bias, that would mean that there are negative studies that the science isn't as firm as we thought it was, but those negative studies are just being hidden. So you're making a circular argument, right? You're saying
it worked very neatly. I must say.
But it's not true. Let's not go off on a let's get sidetracked here. So
too late.
Yeah, this study comes out of Lund University, Johan Hollander, with colleagues from Sweden and Canada, Christian Harlos and Tim Edgel. They looked at 120 research articles published in the field of climate research between 1997 and 2013, and they found no evidence of publication bias. And what they said was that researchers were totally willing to present negative data that were data that might, call into question or complicate, the conclusions about climate change. So there's no attempt being made to hide negative evidence. The only thing they did find in their review, which is completely normal, meaning not that it's good, just meaning that this is what researchers do, is that the interesting, significant results, whatever they were always presented up front, and like non-significant or negative results were sort of hidden in the technical data, in the tables. But no, that is a legitimate beef. And this is, what often does happen is that, researchers will kind of showcase the quote unquote interesting results. And that's what gets in the press release. And that's what gets reported in the media. But the study has all the data, including the negative data or the less interesting data. It's just that they're just presenting a slice of the results that make an interesting story. So that is, I think, something to be aware of. It's something that you can legitimately criticize, but they are publishing all the data, good, bad, indifferent, positive, negative, whatever. There's no publication bias in terms of which evidence they are publishing.
Just promotion bias.
Yeah, right. Which is important though. I mean, not to downplay that. It doesn't change the bottom line conclusions about climate change, though. It's just more about how the science is being communicated to the public, really, is where it comes in. Although there is another type of bias that I've mentioned on the show, but I haven't spoken a lot about, and that is citation bias, that positive studies are more likely to be referenced by other studies. So you see, so the positive studies do tend to feed on themselves in that way, rather than all of the data being looked at equally, And so, the sort of showcasing bias, if you will, does contribute to that. And that is something that I think if we're being really rigorous, we need to work against that as well. But no publication bias doesn't in any way change the consensus about climate change, which is good to know.
Yes.
But I do wonder, Carrie, you mentioned about how this could be exploited. I do wonder if some climate change denier is going to hit upon this more technical criticism to try to parlay that into something that it really isn't.
Yeah, I mean, they'll use whatever.
That's what they do.
I know. Well, good job, guys. That is the first time you swept me this year.
All right.
Yay.
Yep.
Go team.
Not the last.
We'll do it again, yeah.
Evan, before we get to the quote, we do want to mention that registration has opened for NEXUS, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. We have a really great lineup this year.
Yeah, we have a great lineup of speakers. Here are some highlights for 2017. Mike Massimino, who is the astronaut. Carrie, did you ever meet him?
I think I have met him, actually. Yeah.
Well, he's our keynote. It's going to be
that's awesome.
A lot of fun.
He's going to be great.
Yeah, he's
going
to be great. We have Leanne Lord, who is our MC. We have James Randi. You know who he is. We have Gavin Schmidt, who is a NASA climatologist. And we have Britt Marie Hermes, who is a former naturopath who came to the light side. And many, many, many more.
Yeah, really, it's an exciting lineup this year. And, of course, we will be there. We'll be doing a private recording on Thursday night. Randy's going to be doing a show Friday night. And we're having a full day of science-based medicine on Friday. It's going to be, I think, a fun year this year. We're looking forward to it. June 29th to July 2nd, a little bit later than it has been in previous years. We wanted to experiment with having it after school was closed to see if that, you know, makes it easier for students to come. June 29th to July 2nd in New York City at the Fashion Institute of Technology, the same place it was last year. If you've never been, you've got to come to Nexus. If you've been to Nexus before, you know how much fun it is. And we hope to see a lot of our listeners there. If you are an SGU member, you get a discount, and we'll be emailing you the promo code. If you are looking for the code before we send it out, just email us and we'll send you back the code. All right, Evan, give us a quote to end the show.
Yep. Science is made up of mistakes, but they are mistakes which it is useful to make because they lead little by little to the truth. And that is from the book A Journey to the Center of the Earth by Jules Verne.
Oh, wow.
Ooh.
Very cool.
Neat.
The quote came in suggested by listener Damien Tenney from Australia. Thank you, Damien. Appreciate that. And Jules Verne, for those of you who don't know, French novelist, poet, playwright, best known for his adventure novels, Journey to the Center of the Earth being one of them, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea being another, Around the World in 80 Days. He's considered one of the fathers of science fiction.
Yep.
And there's also some debate as to whether or not he is the father of technobabble as well.
Well, the two things kind of go hand in hand, though.
They do kind of go hand in hand, but I guess he used it to such an extent that he became in certain ways known for it. So, and it's a and he's right. You know, we learn so much from the mistakes we make, but try not to repeat them and move on to other things that actually do work. And in a way, that is science.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Evan, and thank you all for joining me this week.
We love you, Steve. We beat you, Steve.
Yes, you did. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.